You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. As I've noted in the past couple of shows, we're really happy that our bookstore, which hosts this show, Wellington Square Bookshop, has just won awards for the best bookstore in Philadelphia and the best coffee shop on the main line. So we're very proud of that. And with regard to this show, we were up to about 200 interviews, including the last three Pulitzer Prize winners and the last two National Book Award winners. And today we're lucky enough to have with us another great author, Paula Hawkins, whose first thriller is The Girl on the Train, which is the story of a woman who finds herself in the middle of a murder. And the unfortunate position of that is not helped by the fact that she's an unreliable witness, an alcoholic, an unhappily divorced woman, and that she's very aware in many ways of the people involved who orbit this mystery. And for us as readers, we are doubly challenged by the fact that this is a mystery thriller narrated by that same unreliable witness, Rachel, who now becomes an unreliable narrator. Girl on the Train was published just last month, but it's already been acclaimed all around the world and translated into who knows how many languages, and has been optioned by DreamWorks. Paula, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
So the first question, how many times have you heard the words Gone Girl in the same sentence in the past month?
I have no idea. Many, many times.
Well, so let's get that out of the way. I mean, there's been so many comparisons in every interview, and I've listened to some of yours, mentions it. And you do say how much you did like that book.
I did. I loved it, and I keep saying I think Amy Dunn is a fantastic creation. It's a wonderful character. I mean, there are lots of good characters in that book, but Amy in particular. And I do see the point of comparison. There are many unreliable narrations. One of them, the way the narratives switch and the time scales are kind of out of sync. That is also quite similar in some ways. We have a complex, flawed female protagonist in both books. But having said that, the protagonists are very, very different. My Rachel, who you've spoken about a bit, the girl on the train, is as you said, an alcoholic. She has lost control of everything in her life. She's lost her job. She's her marriage has broken down. She's really flailing. That character is extremely different to Gillian Flynn's characters. And also, we are seeing somebody who's, whereas Gone Girl is about the breakdown of a marriage, this book is not about that. The marriage is already gone. Well, we're seeing something quite different here.
Yeah, in many ways, Rachel is so bereft of so many things that Gillian's character has, and it's much more difficult for you. To create a character who's not in control, as opposed to being a control freak, really.
Yes, yeah, that is correct, and she is really lost, and she's isolated herself completely, so she's become quite paranoid and obsessive, the way very lonely people can sometimes become. She is really all alone.
Well, and because of that, and again, I'm not doing it in order to compliment you. It's just that it's fascinating how you were able to do it. You have this person who's doesn't have a lot of resources in so many different ways. Yet she somehow, unwittingly or in some strange way, becomes the sleuth. And I know you're interested in Agatha Christie's work, and that's what started you on a lot of this. But how does this person who has this void inside of her, how does she become, in your book, the sleuth of the story?
Well, I think the thing is that she has fixated on this woman, who she calls Jess, and who later she finds out is actually called Megan, who goes missing. She's been fixating on her while she's been on her commute. The train goes past this woman's house, and she's become obsessed with her. She thinks she's the perfect half of a couple, and she's projecting all these feelings onto these people. And when Megan goes missing, she feels that she somehow holds the key to this mystery. She believes that she knows something that the police have missed. So she gets drawn into it that way. But I think you've hit on a good point there, that she is trying to fill a void. And so she sort of seizes on this thing as a way of, it gives her a purpose. She's lost all her purpose. She's lost her job and her family. Now this disappearance gives her sort of a reason to get up in the morning, a reason to stay sober in the morning, a reason to try and you know, get through the day in a more normal way.
And it's funny, as a reader, you know, when she kind of gets excited at times and she goes back and forth, which I actually sometimes do, she gets excited about helping the police or going to visit a certain individual that she, or individual with an S, that she shouldn't actually even be seeing.
Yes.
When she does that and she puts herself in that position, she has created these resources for herself, which, for better or worse, you know, move the novel along.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
And go ahead.
Sorry, yes, no, you can.
Okay, so let's go back to the being the observer on the train, because, you know, your life, at least to that extent, you know, you draw from that portion of your life to begin the story. So talk about how you used to ride the train, and I do too.
Yes. I mean, I used to commute into London at various points of my life. I've made various different commutes across the city, and some of the earlier ones, I would ride a train that went very close to the backs of people's houses, and you could actually see into them. And at this point, it was quite, when I just moved to London, I didn't really know anyone. I was quite lonely, and I felt a bit of an outsider. And I used to look into these houses and sort of imagine the lives of the people there, and I would almost feel a sense of connection. I sort of thought I knew what sort of people they were, and there's something quite comforting about that. About forming that sense of connection. I think when you're in a big city and you're alone, and then much later, I was sort of wandered idly about what you would do if you saw something shocking. I never did. I never saw anything even remotely exciting. But I wondered about you know what sort of witness you would be and how you would react if you saw something. Just glimpse something sinister or surprising on your commute.
Yeah, it's fascinating what we do inside our own heads, which is essentially the only tool we have. But we spin these stories out. And I read this interesting study yesterday about people remembering things like when John F. Kennedy was assassinated or the Challenger explosion. And this one university did a questionnaire where they asked you what you were doing. They did it the day after the explosion. And the people knew exactly what had happened, where they had been, who they had been talking to.
Yes.
And then they made them take the same questionnaire 5 years later. And they all had a level of confidence of 4.6 out of 5. That they knew exactly what had happened. And when they filled it out this time, it was completely wrong.
Really?
Yeah, completely different than what they had written the day after, which goes very much to what your book is about.
Yes.
You know, do you still do that? Do you still, like, even now, do you still, like, when you're traveling, do you look at people and wonder who they are, what their lives are like?
Yes, I do. I do. I always find that fascinating. When you can see, I often idly wonder. I wonder, though, whether the ubiquity of mobile phones that we can connect to the internet with, and that kind of thing, and laptops and all that mobile, whether that slightly will kill that sort of impulse, because everyone's just looking onto their phone rather than looking out the window. But I still like to look around and daydream.
So do I. It's funny, not to keep popping up with studies, but I read another one that said that teenagers are unlearning the ability to discern what facial expressions mean.
Really?
Yeah, so if someone grimaces or looks angry, they're not quite sure because they haven't seen faces.
That's really frightening, actually, isn't it? That's quite worrying.
So out of Megan, Scott, Anna, Tom, and Rachel, who would you say you like or like best?
I think I'm probably Rachel. I feel closest to Rachel, even though she's a mess. But I feel that there is goodness in Rachel, and her impulses, although she makes some very bad judgments because of her addiction, her instincts and her impulses come from a good place. Whereas, to some degree, some of the others tend to be a little bit more self-interested.
You know who I like best?
Who?
Evie.
All right. Yes.
There's nothing.
She is the only blameless one.
True. It is true. And that's another thing that's difficult to do, and is to write a novel in which, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just, each of the characters is flawed.
They are very flawed, and I think we are witnessing them at perhaps a very difficult point in a lot of their lives. They're, all of them are feeling to some extent a bit under threat or precarious. Well, Rachel's in her own particular situation, but Anna's there with this woman who she sees as the crazy ex-wife stalking them, and Meghan has some problems in her past that she's really struggling to deal with, and Scott thinks is not sure what his wife is up to. So they're all, everybody's feeling a bit that their relationships are precarious or that they're in some way threatened, and so I think they are perhaps behaving in slightly less likable ways than they would have done anyway. But yes, you're correct, they're all deeply flawed, but I find flawed characters much more compelling to write about and to read about.
Yeah, I know, it's funny because I listened to the one interview where you said when you were writing much lighter, more romantic stuff, or as actually you said, chick lit, you still had your darker side that wanted to come out. I thought that was pretty funny.
Oh, yes, definitely. And when I was writing those books, the books just kept getting darker and darker. So I eventually just thought perhaps I should be done with that and get on with some crime writing.
Well, the other good thing about the way you handled this and crime writing is that if all of the characters are in precarious positions, either emotionally or for some other real-world situation, it makes them all probable suspects.
Yes.
And you got that from Agatha Christie, too, I think.
Well, yes. but, I mean, I like that. You want that in a crime novel. You want to be able to have a good range of people that could have done it, and you want to suspect everyone. And actually, I think what I find interesting in thrillers is where actually everybody could have done it. Everyone has a credible reason for being involved in the mystery.
Did you know who did it at the beginning?
I did, but
there
were some there were some twists that came along later, but I knew that I had the bare bones of it. I didn't know where I was going.
I always wonder about that, whether it just... So what came to you first, the culprit or the crime?
The crime, yeah. Sort of the situation. What came to me first was that train journey, that moment of seeing something, and then sort of separately I had the character of Rachel in my head. I'd been thinking about writing this character, not necessarily in this story, but in some story, a woman or a person who drinks and can't trust her memories as a result. And I wanted her to be involved in a crime in some way.
Well, you know, so the one thing is, and the other thing is fascinating, and it's in your real life, is that this was published just last month, and now all this has happened. Did you ever expect in a million years that this is what was going to be happening in your life?
No, absolutely not. I was optimistic. The publishers were very pleased, and everyone was saying good things. We had a good response from bloggers and that sort of thing, but. I did not expect to be to this level of excitement and this level of sales quite so soon, or probably ever. I mean, this has just been quite phenomenal.
What do you think it is that makes readership now so intriguing? Well, you know, a lot of the authors I interview have written apocalyptic novels. Like, the apocalypse seems really popular now. Because I think kids like the idea of, you know, I really don't like this world this much. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just wipe the whole thing and start with the tabula rasa? And I think what is it that makes readers like the idea of having someone who's totally unreliable?
I think it, in some ways it draws the reader into the mystery more, because if they can't trust the person who's telling the story, they're almost doing the sleuthing themselves. They've got to figure out what they can trust, what they can't trust, and that immediately draws you into a story. It makes you need to read between the lines and to second guess that the person who's talking, you know, the person who's narrating to you, and I always find that really interesting. So there's that, but I mean, it's a difficult thing to put your finger on why people identify with one book and not with another. I think also the thing about the voyeuristic impulse and the commute, a lot of people identify with that. Perhaps they haven't all done what Rachel does. They don't take it to that extreme, but everyone can kind of see that. People recognize that impulse, and that also draws them into the story.
Well, I think it's, you know, in a simple fashion, it's just a lot of fun. It's fun for the reader. And also, like the blurb, one of the blurbs on your book, where, you know, the idea is that, you know, I couldn't put it down. You know, I had to read it in one sitting.
Yeah.
And then I could be angry at you because I started it at 9. I have to take my kids to the school bus at 5:30 in the morning. You ruined an entire night's sleep for me.
I've heard that a couple of times. Yes, lots of people hate me.
The one thing about an unreliable narrator is you can't write an unreliable narrator. Then readers get upset.
Yeah.
Your unreliable narrator has to be reliable.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you about this. It's I'm so happy for your good fortune and, you know, your book. Oh, it's so funny. I was at my bookstore today, and someone comes up and goes, "What's this book, you know, A Girl on a Train about?" I said, "I'm interviewing her in 2 hours. And it'll be broadcast next week." So in the next half hour, we sold 10 copies of your book.
Really?
Yeah. It was
fantastic.
So funny.
I know. Oh, well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, too. It works both ways. That was Paula Hawkins, and I really enjoyed the end there because it just happened to be true. I mean, I was just about ready to get into my car, and these four people came into the bookstore. It was already pretty crowded, and they came in because they saw us on Yelp. And then they couldn't find it, which is hard to find us the first time. And so they used their GPS to guide them in. And the first thing they say when they walked in is, "We heard about this book called Girl on a Train." And it's been out of stock everywhere because it's gotten so popular so quickly. You know, it was released January 13th. It's not even a month, 3 weeks. And so we just got a whole bunch of them in today. In the next hour, we sold them all. And I think, I know she must be sick of the comparisons to Gone Girl, but she handled it very diplomatically. But this book is different because in Gone Girl, you have a protagonist who's completely within herself, completely in control, hyper-control. And here you have this woman, Rachel, who has no control at all over her life, yet somehow, not like Columbo, but somehow in this strange fashion, she's able to cobble together this random walk through life and through the situations of these people until she, I won't give anything else away, but she becomes intimately involved in the solution of this mystery thriller. So it's fun doing these kinds of books because normally I'm not a mystery reader. You know, if I had, I would stick to, you know, if I could, I could stick to science fiction and science writing. I love that. But it's been such a pleasure being able to interview this wide, wide range of authors in various, various topics, history and historical fiction and magical fiction and science and nonfiction and memoirs like last week. So that's what's great about this. These are books I might not read, but I'm so glad that I have. And like I said, we're coming up on 200 of them. So continue to join us if you have been. If not, tell somebody. Every week we have someone new. We are now in a position that the publicists are actually coming after us, which is great. It makes me feel so proud. Upcoming guests include Alexandra Fuller, Rebecca Sherm, Catherine Haney, and Emma Walsh. And each of those books are masterpieces in their own right, and we try to get the ones that we think are going to be at the top. And with that, and me going on and on as I usually do, thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to you listening to another one of our broadcasts next week. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.